I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Here are the terms of the game this hour. The volcanic eruption of Trump power in 2016 certified a breakdown of an old order, full collapse of a worn-out boomer regime. The question of Trump's first 100 days is whether the Republic is on a straight road to ruin or perhaps to a roundabout revival. It's a test, really, of circles against straight lines. It's a test of the cycles of American history and the renewal of generations, marking reinvention at regular intervals in the past. Out of colonial rebellion, a new country in the 1770s. Then 80 years later, out of catastrophic civil war. And 80 years after that, out of the abyss of depression and World War II. 80 years to this day, and another turn is overdue. But map and directions are still missing. We're looking for them in the framework built by hobby historians William Strauss and Neil Howe. 2 decades ago, Strauss and Howe started writing The History of America's Future. Bestsellers like The Fourth Turning that had cult staying power still do. Steve Bannon, who's playing navigator on the Trump ship, credits Strauss and Howe as his masterminds. Our guest, David Kaiser, a prolific historian of the PhD sort, reads Strauss and Howe his own way.
For me, as a historian, the key to the Strauss-Howe idea is the 80-year period, which they called a seculum, a Latin word for a human life, and the 80-year cycle within it, which concludes with a great crisis that destroys an old order and creates a new one. The seculum that we are in begins about 1946, which is the year in which a great many members of the GI generation who are going to be very influential come into political power. John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon, for instance, are both elected to Congress. The high lasts until about 1964. The awakening begins then and lasts for about another 20 years.
Mid-Reagan.
Yes, and then the unraveling begins sometime in the Reagan era, around 1984, and lasts, in my opinion, until the middle of 2001, when 9/11 really kicks off the crisis.
By the crisis, Kaiser means the ragged end of a long era. We're there right now, when key players can look and feel lost.
You do realize that a number of people in history did see it in one way or another, including, interestingly enough, Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt.
Here's FDR, sounding themes of cycles and generations in the depths of the Depression crisis, 1936.
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
10 years later, JFK was home from the war and running for Congress, 1946. His slogan was, "The new generation offers a leader."
And in his inaugural address, he also referred to himself as the first representative of his generation.
Yes.
To reach the White House, as he certainly was.
"Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans."
Kennedy was a great representative of the GI generation. Like 10 million other young men, he had just gone through the experience of the Second World War. And in politics, they put to work the values that the war had taught them of cooperation, of sacrifice for the group, opening up opportunity for average people.
Through the great Eisenhower years, rebuilding, expansion.
Yes, and
highways.
Then the Kennedy and early Johnson years.
There's a Ford in your future.
Right.
GI Bills.
GI Bills.
Housing in the burbs.
Yes, housing in the burbs, infrastructure. Schools are going all over the country for the boomers, their kids. Meanwhile, we've adopted this role of defending freedom all over the globe. It gets us into some trouble in Korea, but we continue with it. But the country is fundamentally optimistic. The country wants to do great things. And one of the great symbols of the high is the space race, which Kennedy escalates
right.
in 1961 to go to the moon.
"But why, some say, the moon? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
That's the high. I remember it well.
Then, however, on the eve of the awakening, the next stage, the GI generation makes a dreadful mistake by embarking upon the Vietnam War.
Comes the awakening.
Yes, comes the awakening, a revolt of the younger generation. In the case of my own boom generation, the big new issue was Vietnam, although because of the draft, I think, and the control it exerted over young men, that broadened out very quickly with the boom generation standing for a much higher degree of individual freedom.
It's rights, it's Vietnam especially.
It's rights, it's Vietnam, but more than that, it's about who decides who people get to be. It's a revolt against uniformity. It's a little bit like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. It's a revolt against this perfect world that their parents have created for them.
Yeah, there was a book, We Are the Kids Our Parents Warned Us Against.
Yes, exactly. It says, we want different values.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word. Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
A famous boomer just lost the presidential election, announces at her commencement.
Hillary Clinton.
Yes, Hillary Clinton. We want sexual freedom. We want more meaningful work, et cetera, et cetera.
We're searching for a more immediate, ecstatic, and penetrating mode of living. Every protest, every dissent is unabashedly an attempt to forge an identity in this particular age.
And there's all this idealism. The awakening's a great era for music. It's a great era for film. In other words, it's a great era culturally.
Comes Ronald Reagan in the awakening. He called it morning in America.
Yes.
We knew better. Probably he did too.
It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better. Why would we ever want to return to where we were less than four short years ago?
Was Reagan, in hindsight, the embodiment of unraveling?
Reagan kicks off the unraveling. The unraveling begins around 1984. The problems that George H.W. Bush had as president are symptomatic of the unraveling, in that he made a good, sensible GI generation decision that taxes had to be raised because the deficit was out of control. The younger members of his own party, led by Newt Gingrich, went into a total revolt and almost drove him out of office, really. I think that crippled him up against Bill Clinton. And then comes the event which, in my opinion, kicks off the crisis.
Which is?
9/11.
We have suffered great loss. And in our grief and anger, we have found our mission and our moment. Our nation, this generation, will lift a dark threat of violence from our people and our future.
In your reading, David Kaiser, George W. Bush sort of seized the turn a little prematurely. He didn't succeed at it exactly, but we're still working on his agenda in the military intelligence complex, but also in the ease up on taxes trend. Place Obama in there. A lot of people thought he embodied the turn. What happened?
We really thought this was going to be the New Deal all over again. And we weren't the only ones. I mean, Time magazine had a cover showing Obama as FDR, and that image was all over the place.
Hmm.
But it turns out that Barack Obama, a man who had risen very smoothly through our established order, trusted it. It is clear that Obama was convinced that the system just needed some tinkering and fixing, and perhaps a bit more regulation in Dodd-Frank, but that was about it. It is such an irony that Roosevelt, a true aristocrat who had spent his whole life among the elite, nonetheless was much more skeptical about their assumptions than Obama, who had risen really from well down in the middle class, thanks to the educational system, as so many people do.
So there's suspense about where this fourth turning turns, even about whose hand is on the wheel. George W. Bush reached for it. Barack Obama seemed to turn away from it. Didn't aspire to a transformational role, he said. We're still talking about it because Donald Trump's resident guru, Steve Bannon, is a devout reader of Strauss and Howe and feels that he's directing the turn, but he hasn't published his map.
Well, Bannon reads a lot. He had read the books a long time ago. He'd certainly read them by 2008 when he interviewed me about them. And he has sweeping goals involving the destruction of the influence of our current elites, political, cultural, perhaps economic, and the creation of some kind of new political order. And he wants to take down the whole, most of the federal government as it has grown up since the progressive era.
Here's a bit of Bannon when he was making political films about 6 years ago and rapped about generations on a TV show for young voters.
The financial crisis today is your generation's Vietnam. You have the unfortunate problem of having to pay for a baby boom that came before you, but you're not going to really have anybody in back of you that's able to pick up the tab for your own. Unless this discussion changes rapidly, like the debt discussions just went on in Washington, your generation is literally going to be wiped out even before it starts.
Does Steve Bannon have a theory here?
I think he has several theories, but I'm not sure he really has a coherent vision. But he's determined not to blame the financial crisis on the capitalist system or on the bankers. He's got to blame it on the government. This is a characteristic of fourth turnings. The political rhetoric always gets heated up. There's always an argument about what a fact is. Different camps always start living in alternative realities. This is what a lot of George Orwell's writing from the last fourth turning is about. The essay Notes on Nationalism is particularly good about this. But now, whether Bannon really has any idea how to help the people who elected Trump and really has a coherent plan for the future, I think is a very open question. It's not at all clear to me that he does.
The last of David Kaiser's many books is No End Save Victory on FDR in World War II. History Unfolding is the name of David Kaiser's blog. Coming up, in the cycle's race, clarity is in the rearview mirror. Merck is in the windshield ahead. This is Open Source. John Stauffer is the son of a Missouri newspaper man, a younger historian at Harvard now, a historian of 19th century America, drawn especially to the giants of the mid-century, the one-time slave Frederick Douglass and President Abraham Lincoln. John Stauffer, you're in a sort of a momentous peak of high thinking of in the Civil War, Lincoln's role, et cetera. Where do you see cycles at work, past, present, future?
I see less cycles and more Lincoln, Douglass's, the Civil War era's generation's vision of progress. So the analogy would be Lincoln, after the Kansas-Nebraska Act, became lifted, he said the act lifted him off its feet. It opened northern territories to slavery. He said that after this, his faith in progress, meaning that the ultimate extinction of slavery would occur, has been destroyed. And so he helps to found the Republican Party. He becomes the head. And the Republican Party, we became a revolutionary party. The foundation of it was that slavery was a social and economic evil, and the main platform was that to prohibit its spread with the aim of ultimate extinction. And so
the point was the evil of it, not so much the moment of transition or something.
That's right. That's right. So essentially after, in the 1850s, he came to understand that because of the aggressiveness of slave-owning Southerners, what people called the slave power, trying to nationalize slavery, now there was a moment of declension. And Frederick Douglass felt the same way, although Douglass was a revolutionary, and he believed that although things were sliding down, slavery was expanding, that tomorrow or next week or soon, there could be a radical transformation, a radical shift. And ultimately, he was correct in a civil war that creates this this social and cultural revolution. And
bring that sense into the present day, 2017, early Trump. What do you see driving the crisis or the chaos inside it?
So Trump is very, for many people, he's very radical in trying to turn back all of the past 60 years in terms of the power, the role of the federal government, the welfare state. For most of his enemies, he demonizes or alienates non-whites. And it was actually very similar to the slave power, pro-slavery Southerners. They hated the federal government. They hated the federal government because if the federal government could create a United States post office and create a national bank and subsidize roads and canals and help to modernize America, it could also interfere with slavery and race relations. And the fear of the federal government for Trump and for Republicans is that it can interfere with individuals' own sense of freedom or of values, whether it's guns or money. And what's ironic about Trump is that he is among the 1% in the same way that the slaveholders were the 1%. They were the wealthiest 1% of the day, the true capitalists. And Trump's greatest base is the poor whites, whose poor Southern whites in particular, whose ideal was to become slave owners, acquire new land. Jackson was a kind of counterpoint. Jackson and the pro-slavery coalition sought to acquire vast new land for slavery to open the way for the American dream for poor Southern whites to acquire slaves and more land and then become rich. And Trump is playing into the poor white and small town and mostly Southern America, and like Jackson, his counterpart, saying that global free markets are penalizing you, sacrificing your jobs, and what we need are tariffs. Jackson accepted tariffs, even though many of his slave owners did not.
John, I want to come back in a moment to the incredible contrast between Trump and the whole Roosevelt program and constituency. But I want to introduce Ariane Chernock, too, an American historian of culture and gender who also writes a lot about Victorian England. To be simple about it, Ariane, we need a feminist eye on this whole cycles game, which can get very characteristically a game for boys talking about their guy heroes. What are we missing here in this cycles bit?
Well, listening to David Kaiser relay these cycles or turns in history, there were no women in that story. I was really struck by that. Look, I think that turns or generations, these are wonderfully useful heuristics. They're devices we use to make sense of what is our very messy, complicated world. But what that emphasis leaves out is, well, in part, divides within generations. What a generation or moment looks like can be very different for someone depending on their gender, their race, their ethnicity, class. And so there's a lot more nuance in these kinds of moments that we need to be attentive to, right? Generation doesn't solve all the problems or explain the situation.
And even I can see that Strauss and Howe, I find it fascinating, but they leave out almost entirely sort of simple-minded economic, take-home pay, economic opportunity, class. And they also leave out the power of ideals and dreams, like social justice or gender justice or racial justice.
And those ideals can transcend generations. I think that that's another really key point we want to bear in mind, and that often it's in these moments of crisis or opposition that you see a strong intergenerational bond being forged.
Intergenerational.
Yes.
Old and young,
old and young.
What do you see at stake in the fight of generations and divisions in this fight for the Trump turn?
Well, I think that it's really brought a new kind of clarity and sense of purpose to oppositional politics in this country. That would be my more hopeful takeaway. As a historian of women and gender, seems that in my classrooms, at least, the stakes have gotten much higher since November, and there's a new investment, not just amongst my students, but amongst my colleagues, people I talk to, in actually clarifying our arguments and working together to try to solve problems.
I think it's very real, and I think you may even understate it. What's the chance, do you see, Ariane, that it won't be the Trump era, it'll be defined by the opposition and the way they do or don't intersectionally, as they say, get together and define an alternative?
I think if you look at American history and world history, some of our strongest moments have been these oppositional moments. And it's in the force of exclusion, antagonism, that defining movements have really taken shape.
When would you cite where the rabble, the people,
right,
the opposition took over the era?
Well, if I think about the women's movement, which I'm a historian of, where did they first gain clarity? In 1840, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott attended a world anti-slavery conference in London where they were denied a voice at the table. And it was their anger, how incensed they were by that experience of being excluded from a movement they cared about, that encouraged them to go and then create a women's movement in America. And 10 years later, they were meeting in Worcester. So I think these kinds of moments of opposition, disappointment even for many people, frustration, can be incredible sources of creativity and realignments.
How many battles and what kinds of battles does the opposition have to win with Donald Trump to define the era, as they did in one moment anyway? First around the immigration, the travel ban, but second around healthcare.
I mean, I think we're seeing this kind of steady chipping away, persistence. You know, it's a doggedness that I think we've seen in other moments in history, an unrelenting, steady opposition that is still searching also for solutions. I don't think we have all the answers yet. I think this is still a moment that's kind of very much in the balance.
The big question for me is Donald Trump going to get to capture the turn? And put his mark on it. But there's another question that won't go away, and that is, did Barack Obama miss the turn and miss his moment to define it? Not just with that, there was that extraordinary Time magazine cover photoshopped Obama's face into FDR's hat and convertible with the cigarette on a stick. But is this suspense created by what Barack Obama didn't do, John?
I think you're right. I think that Obama, a central tenet of his presidency within the Democratic Party was this myth of a meritocracy, particularly a meritocracy based on education.
Hmm.
And Trump's allies, the people who elected Trump, thought that myth of meritocracy was truly a myth and a sham, that today, given the cost of state colleges at $30,000 or more, given the state of K through 12 education, and particularly a lot of small towns, especially in the South, the opportunity through education to be able to realize the so-called American dream or get ahead doesn't exist. And private schools, every elite private school, a third of the students are legacy students. It does not exist. And Trump supporters and Trump tried to expose that myth of a meritocracy that Obama was, in a sense, blind to. And I agree that he tinkered with the existing system in a way that he could have dramatically changed it, in possibly, particularly given the fact that when he became president, the Dow was standing at 6,000 and there was the worst economic crash.
That's a profound point, and you express it very, very well. The simple fact that the college education, the GI Bill supremely, but expanded the middle class, built the middle class.
Yes.
Today, it is contracting the middle class. That's an extraordinary shift, but nobody has a handle on it. I'm sure a lot of people who see it voted for Trump in frustration. I don't think he's going to help them at all.
That's right.
But
why can't people...
There's an issue that could define this era, Ariane, if somebody would grab it, dramatize it. Elizabeth Warren sort of faints at it, but what do you think?
I think we do have to talk about class in ways that are open and honest and frank. And
talk about the mechanism of reality that is producing the 1%.
Exactly. Yes, yes. And that is the story here.
Yes. And in some sense, it's class and vis-a-vis or in relation to race and gender, because Trump's base is white men. white men who feel alienated from this myth of meritocracy. That's who he speaks to, whether even before the election, of the birther movement that he helped found is essentially a way of saying it's illegitimate for a black man to become president. We can't say that, but because we can make up the lie that he wasn't born in the United States, that can work. And so at times there's this tension, which I completely agree. I think that people who voted for Trump are going to be disillusioned. And I agree with you, Arianna, that one of the effects of Trump's presidency so far is the degree to which there has been democracy in the streets in ways that haven't occurred since, 20, 30 years, not just in Boston, New York, but throughout the country.
And the world.
And the world. It's very heartening. It's very heartening. And so, and the same thing happened in the Civil War era. The fugitive slave law radicalized millions of Northerners against slavery. Before that law, you could say they might not have liked slavery, but they said, it's not my problem. I don't need to worry about it. After the fugitive slave law, it is my problem because I can be deputized in this. African-American, who's my neighbor, might be, who happens to be a fugitive, could be captured. The same thing happens with Trump's executive order,
absolutely,
where you have sanctuary cities throughout the North. Boston, which was an abolition hotbed, is a major sanctuary city. Trudeau opens Canada in the same way Canada was open to fugitive. It's the fugitive slave crisis all over again. And it's truly
absolutely
mobilized millions of Northerners.
John Stoffer, you quoted to me that marvelous line from Orwell in Animal Farm, who controls the past, controls the future, and who controls the present, controls the past.
Yes, from 1984.
Back to the large matter of cycles and the way we picture our past. What does this cycles notion, in all of our heads, what does it reveal? What does it conceal?
So what
where we are?
I think what it reveals, Orwell's point, it reveals a few things, is that how one tells the story of the past is hugely empowering for how one thinks about the present and the future. In one sense, you could say that history is the activist's muse, the activist on the left or on the right. So take Steve Bannon. If he believes in the cycle and he believes that this new turn is going to occur in 2 or 3 years, that could be greatly inspiring and mobilizing for him to say, I'm going to help bring this about, regardless of whether or not it actually occurred. In the same way that in the Civil War era, throughout most of the 20th century, people denied that it was about slavery. It was about these inevitable differences. And so it affirmed the Jim Crow segregation and the unfree status of most blacks in the United States. And so the past helps to make sense of and actually supports and becomes an activist engine for the present and the future.
Arianna, I want your take on what this whole notion of a sort of spring, summer, fall, winter cycle reveals or hides.
I completely agree with John on this one. The labeling itself, who gets to do that labeling, puts that person in an incredible position of power. Because by describing the past, you are calling it into reality to some extent.
Yes.
The fact that we are seeing our world in terms of these generations, these eras, these moments. Who are the people labeling?
Yes.
I'm always
yes.
reminded of a wonderful article in my field called Did Women Have a Renaissance?
That's right. That's
because
right.
for the women That's who lived right. through the Renaissance, they probably didn't experience
That's
that as
right.
a Renaissance.
That's right. In the same way you can look at American history textbooks, American history writing up until almost yesterday, and it's still a white man's history, a white man's democracy.
I want Arianna to define this in your own terms, and they're fascinating, the turn we're in. This I think, end of the boomer reign, something is up. We don't know who owns it yet. Describe it.
I think it's a moment of opposition. I think we're going to see new clarity around this oppositional politics that's mobilizing. I don't know where it's leading. I'm not a prescriber as a historian. I don't think that's my role. But I have been really energized, as John was saying, by the democracy in the streets and by the intergenerational activism.
I think a lot of people see it and feel it, that Donald Trump, was an anti-vote. I'm not sure who's going to break the news to him that it wasn't a vast love or belief in him or his anything he said, but it was a no, a profound no to somebody, to something, and who's going to define it? How would you sum it up, Arianna, in a way, in a in what could be a political speech, definition, alliance?
You know, I think it's that before Trump, I think people were kind of self-absorbed. They were obsessed with their specific issues. It was kind of a single issue kind of way of mobilizing. I think now we're thinking again more broadly about larger visions and looking outward in a more broad, even global way, you know, at what the common values are that people share, what is at stake, and trying to bring the real issues back into the conversation.
Can you mobilize it, John Stover? Or?
I completely agree with that. I think that a number of there's necessarily speculative polls that suggested that based on the numbers, had it been an election between Trump and Bernie Sanders, Bernie would have won by several points. Now, that reflects both what I and many others see as the ongoing discrimination or against women, the greater difficulty for a woman to be a leader than for a man. But also, Bernie understood the degree to which the welfare state and the foundation since FDR has been just gutted out.
John Stoffer, stand by. And Ariane, too. Coming up, millennials as the hero generation. What if it's going to take a miracle generation to redeem the mess we're leaving them? This is Open Source. The popular authors of Cycle Thinking About American History, William Strauss and Neil Howe, saw major trouble ahead when they wrote The Fourth Turning 20 years ago. "We yearn," they wrote, "for civic character, but we satisfy ourselves with symbolic gestures and celebrity circuses. No greatness in our leaders, a new meanness in ourselves." They said, "History is seasonal and winter is coming." And those were the good old days, 1997, before 9/11, before the Iraq War, before Katrina and Sandy and the climate crisis every day, before we saw mass incarceration for what it was and is. I put it to the master historian Sean Willents at Princeton whether our sense of cycles goes deep and dark enough for our real condition today. Are we euphemizing our situation? He laughed despite himself.
I think we should start saying it. We're in deep trouble.
He said, laughing.
I mean, only because it's some sort of deep brain reflex when faced with that much terror, really. Let me put it this way. The United States is going through now the greatest stress test to its own political system that it has had since the Civil War. Mm. That is what we're going through. We're going to be testing our institutions. Already in the first 80, 90 days of the administration, the courts have been tested, the media has been tested, all of the systems that are central to democracy are all being tested to the max, really. Now, if the United States passes that stress test, it'll be one outcome. If it doesn't, and it might not, well, then it really is a revolutionary situation and it would be just as scary as people think, especially when you throw in the Putin factor in foreign policy. I mean, quite apart from the Middle East, you know, geopolitics in particular have been shifted. And if President Trump is intent on breaking down the Western alliance as it's, you know, come to exist since World War II and trade it in for some other new world order where presumably the Russians and the Americans will rule the world together, it may not be the apocalypse, but it's a very, very different world than anything you and I have been used to, and a very different kind of democracy than you and I have ever been used to.
And we haven't mentioned the inequality disease that, you know, those tax cuts will make worse if he gets them, not to mention mass incarceration about a constituency that he barely acknowledges. I mean, it could be serious.
The tax cut business, the inequality, yes, very much so. When we talk about democracy, it's not just about how, you know, elections are going to be conducted, which also should be pointed out as well. I mean, you know, voting rights, all of that is now deeply threatened, or greater than it has been since the 60s, and voting rights is essential. But, you know, you throw an economic, you know, what Whitman talks about, this great reticulation, he used to call it, of wealth, that America was a place where you didn't have these kinds of extremes, that the system was geared towards, you know, preventing those kinds of extremes, which are very dangerous for democracy. That tax bill goes through, I mean, whew, it's extraordinary.
Big question, Sean Willents. Is the turn still turning? We're in the so-called crisis phase of the Strauss-Howe period. Not really resolved. What could happen here?
One of the things that I think that the Fourth Turning talks about, and I know that Bannon talks about, is war. and what war can do to break things up, break up log jams. Wars break up log jams in history. Well, what kind of war we might be talking about? Iran, North Korea, plenty of tinderboxes, plenty of places you could imagine it happening. That's a very frightening prospect. And, you know, if you want to get apocalyptic, you know, that would be the first place to go, I think.
Consider others. California secession, the sanctuary state, a real division of the red and blue America. Or consider also the Koch brothers' Constitutional Convention. Let's get it started in the state legislatures, which we own, and rewrite the rules.
Yeah, I mean, I've been very concerned about the last of those, Chris. The proposition is being put forth that, you know, you can go in and do some tinkering with the Constitution of the United States from 1787, that we can just tinker here and there, and we can come up with a better Constitution. That's not what's going to happen. I mean, a Constitutional Convention, once it's called, can rewrite everything and will rewrite everything. Mm. And compare Charles and David Koch with, you know, James Madison and James Wilson. You know, yikes! It's a very scary proposition. Then, if that's the case, and it's unclear where the Kochs and the Trumps and all these people, the Mercers and all these right-wing people line up, but if that happens, then it is a revolution. I mean, it's just a revolution. That's what have occurred. And that's what they're aiming for, nothing less.
Sean Willents has won two Bancroft Prizes, the last for The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, in 2005. Sean Scott joins us from Seattle, certified millennial, cultural commentator, and writer. His big book forthcoming is Millennials and the Moment That Made Us, A Cultural History of the U.S., 1982 to the Present. Sean, welcome. Have we heaped enough assignments on the rising gen to save us?
Well, I think when you sort of interrogate the Hausstrauss framework, even and especially on its own terms, right, it makes a certain allowance for the fact that there needs to be in the middle of a great crisis, what they term as a hero generation. Now, I think generational thinking, especially as Hausstrauss sort of practice it, can often sort of look like the zodiac in some ways. It can be very, very surface level, but nonetheless, I think when you introduce sort of that framework to where we've actually been for the last 35 years, which is about as old as the oldest millennials are currently, you can sort of review the amount of things that we've seen and that have been packed into those years that really suggest that our generation in particular, and the millennial generation, which Hausstrauss believe were born starting the year 1982, really have quite a large deal of a responsibility as far as correcting many of the excesses that we saw from the baby boomer generation starting in the mid-70s.
In general, in this large canvas before us, Sean, do the millennials have a play? Are they would they want to seize the moment? Would they know what to do with it?
Well, we've been seizing it at least dramatically and at least in the realm of pop culture for 25 years now, right? You go back and you think about the number of popular films that we've seen that sort of posit millennials as the hero generation of peacemakers and of problem solvers. Everything from, you know, Home Alone in 1990 to Curly Sue the same year, The Parent Trap in 1998, Sleepless in Seattle, Free Willy. All of these films, what they have in common is sort of they cast child stars and kids that were born in the middle 1980s and saying everything from divorce to environmental catastrophe to war to death. You think about Captain Planet and the Planeteers. Those really are the responsibility of children to come along and fix those things. And so what it does is it's sort of a twofold straight. On the one hand, there's quite a burden generationally on millennials, which we've talked about, but that it's also kind of manifests itself as an excuse for many baby boomers to sort of behave in very, very reckless ways, because after all, how would Strauss say they're supposed to be a hero generation? They're going to come along and they're going to make it all better. So, you know, no excess can be too excessive if you're a member of the previous generation as far as the Hausstrauss framework is concerned.
Sean, I'm wondering, you know, in all the generation talk, you know, down on the boomers, over-promising for the millennials, whether it's not all a way of disguising the real pain here, including especially the economic pain that John Stuffer was talking about. I mean, how do you connect, what's the reality inside this it was a Strauss-Howe invention, the very word millennials?
Well, I think that's exactly what it is. I think that you look at Neil Howe's career and as sort of the founder of Life Course Associates, which was a they started off as a marketing firm. So you see a lot of in ads that started in the 1980s, be it the 1984 ad by Apple or Pepsi's New Generation ad, really an attempt to sort of commodify and sell baby boomers, sort of the early descent that they saw in the mid 1960s. I think that you can see something similar happening even up until yesterday, right?
I mean, I was just going to say the Pepsi ad.
Right. Pepsi had a giant, giant dust up over the fact that they really tried to go in there and commodify the work that activists have been doing on the streets of Ferguson, on the streets of New York City, online, on Twitter and social networking sites. Not quite knowing that millennials, I think, sort of witnessed sort of that earlier script for previous generations, but are not going to take the commodification of our social movements and real dissent for granted, and certainly not going to allow it to be sullied by, you know, carbonated sugar water.
I was just going to say, I mean, Ariane, did you follow this Pepsi thing yesterday? I mean, selling sugar water, as Sean puts it, with this long commercial designed to run online, 2 or 3 minutes, but it's an endless spin on prototypes and models of youth behavior, their market, with every kind of flattery and romanticization, but also stereotypes. I mean, you pull back the curtain on this generational thing, and you're looking at a marketing machine.
Absolutely. It, marketing, I mean, what Sean was saying, this is critical to understanding this lens for viewing the progress of history, if we want to call it that, or generational development. It's a strategy for getting a particular kind of vision enacted in the world. And we have to see it that way. We have to be savvy about how it's being applied to make sense of our world.
How do you handle it, Sean? I mean, to treat millennials and their problems, it's not that they're millennials, it costs $250,000 today to get a professional education.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just plain money.
I do think that there is something to that. I think that, you know, Neil Howe, who himself is a baby boomer, I think the sort of vision of American history that he was putting forward really hinged on the particular moment in history that he was describing, right? So writing a lot of these books in the 1980s and 1990s and sort of projecting outward and saying, you know, this must have been the case for how it was for previous generations, where I think the reality is that we've never seen, in fact, a generation quite as entitled as the baby boomers have been. We've never seen a generation that has sopped up as many social entitlements, nor had as many social entitlements at their disposal. We've never seen the level of wealth accumulation that we've seen in this country at this point. So to the extent that that is an exceptional historical situation, the situation of the millennials is unique. All that said, I do think that you can find as many baby boomers and members of Generation X, members of the Silent Generation, who have sort of gotten the short end of the stick. And really, we're not talking about baby boomers categorically as all capitalists categorically. As a matter of fact, you can find, the New York Times just last year ran a story about aging baby boomers who sort of at the end of the line don't have as many of the comforts as they've come to be promised by Social Security, for example. So it's not generational categories just on their own that we should be diagnosing, but I do think that in many ways when we wade into these conversations, we're really talking about them as a proxy for class and for the way that we distribute and do not distribute resources.
Stand by, Sean Scott. I want you, John Starford, to come back to Sean Willens's point, not only about where we are, the biggest stress test that the Republic has ever had, but also that there are revolutionary warnings here.
Yes, I think it is a huge stress test, possibly. I don't know if I agree with the biggest stress test since the Civil War, but the analogy of the Civil War, I'll just go back to emphasizing what I had said, is that the aggressiveness, the belligerence of the slave power, of the slave owners of the South, if you liken that to Trump's belligerence or the belligerence of the present Republican Party, what that ultimately does is to radicalize or revolutionize the left, and both in the Civil War era and today, I completely agree, the intergenerational aspects of young, old, blacks, whites, men, women, mobilizing, taking democracy to the streets, and being very vocal about defining their understanding of America as a pluralist, multiracial, and ethnic democracy in a way that we don't want to take it back to where it used to be. I think that's a crucial point. So can there be a kind of revolutionary crisis? What is a revolution? A revolution is when social change can happen very quickly rather than very gradually. It can include violence. It doesn't have to include violence. Yes, we might have this revolutionary moment in which change occurs quickly. It might manifest itself in a recapitulation of the two-party system. In fact, one of the reasons why the right and the Republican Party has reigned so dominant today is that liberals, a lot of liberals for decades, had been blind to the radicalism, the truly revolutionary nature of the far right, which has taken the center far to the right of where it was three decades ago, and such that most people recognize that Richard Nixon would be considered a socialist today. Barry Goldwater would be seen as a centrist today.
Ariane Turner, why would Donald Trump or Steve Bannon, if they're two people, be catalyzing this kind of revolutionary spirit?
Well, listening to John, I think one of the ironies we may take away 10, 15 years from now is that it's the Trump presidency that creates, I mean, this is my hopeful reading, right. But creates the polity that we thought we were getting when Obama was first elected.
Agree. Talk about irony, but it makes complete sense.
Yeah, agree.
Spell it out.
Well, no, I just think that now people really do feel, again, this incredible sense of urgency. People are mobilizing in the ways that when Obama was in power, I think there was a bit of a kind of self-satisfied smugness, passivity to some extent that crept into American discourse and certainly kind of commitments.
Sean Scott, your view. I mean, John says that Bernie might have beaten Donald Trump. I wonder, even in the light of what you're saying, Ariane, that Michelle Obama might have beaten Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
Sean Scott, what do you think?
Right. Well, for many millennial voters, and we have sort of the benefit of hindsight looking back to the first waves of millennial voters who turned out in 2004, as I did, and then again in 2008, especially, that really that vote for Barack Obama, especially in particular when you look at the rising rates of minority enfranchisement and the amount of African Americans in particular that voted at rates that that had never been seen before. That was really in sort of a post-Katrina era, an act of desperation. I think that there was a real sense and a real frustration that ran pretty, pretty deep. And so that maybe there were other reasons that had, you know, that some people who may have turned out for John Kerry in 2004 may have turned out for Barack Obama in 2008 for ideological reasons. But I do think it's kind of I push back a little bit on the notion that, you know, Barack Obama was somebody who people only wanted in there for sort of a level of maintenance of the status quo that was already established. I think that there was a real frustration and a real desperation behind the generation that put him in office as far as millennials are concerned.
John Stoffer, what about the very idea of a right-wing revolution, a Koch brothers-inspired constitutional convention?
I think we're seeing that to a degree with Trump's election.
No, but I mean, I'm talking about real progress toward, you know, rewriting the charter.
I think that would be hard to actually implement. So if you look at the Civil War era, the Supreme Court and the one of the most infamous Supreme Court decisions in American history is the Dred Scott decision of 1857. Mm-hmm. One of the tenets is that it calls the central platform of the Republican Party unconstitutional. The platform was to prohibit the spread of slavery into the federal territories. Justice Taney in a 7-2 majority decision said that's unconstitutional. Blacks have never been and will never be citizens. Their natural condition is that of slaves. And the Republican Party just thumbs their nose, just ignores the Supreme Court, ignores the court. I mean, so what would happen under Trump presidency if Roe v. Wade were overturned? In my view, that would absolutely revolutionize a vast majority of the American populace.
I agree.
Thank you. Oh, this is enormously interesting, and we'll do it again. Thank you, Sean Scott, John Stoffer, Ariane Chernock. Thanks also to David Kaiser and Sean Willens. Our show was produced by a crew of millennials: Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our boomer engineer. Mary McGrath is our ageless leader. I'm Christopher Lydon, straight out of the silent generation and proud of it. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.